We're coming to the end of our study through Philippians, and in our text today, we have Paul reaching a sort of climax of this. In fact, he's going to indicate this by saying, I've found the secret. And when he says that, he means it as like, in the parlance of the time, it's like, I've found the life hack. I've found the thing. Right? That everybody's looking for this thing. Everybody's trying to understand happiness. Everybody's trying to find, like, what is the secret way into this elusive thing called contentment? And Paul goes, I'm going to tell you what it is. Are you ready? So Philippians chapter 4, verse 10 through 14. Paul says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly because once again you renewed your care for me. You were in fact concerned about me, but lacked the opportunity to show it. I don't say this out of need, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstance I find myself. I know how to make do with a little, and I know how to make do with a lot. In any and all circumstances, I've learned the secret of being content. Whether well-fed or hungry, whether in abundance or in need, I'm able to do all things through him who strengthens me. Still, you did well by partnering with me in my hardship. The word of the Lord. Now, before we kind of unpack that, I'm curious to ask, is there some sort of place you go, like television series, for comfort? Does anybody have like that place where they're like, oh, when I just need some stability, this is where I turn, right? One of mine is All Creatures Great and Small. It's this like veterinary doctor out in England, kind of post-World War I, and like everything turns out all right, life is stable, life is calm, yeah, there's a sick animal, but don't worry, by the end it's saved, and like you're like, oh, comfort, right? But the other place that I go, if I'm honest, more than anywhere else, is to this series called Band of Brothers. Does anybody watch Band of Brothers? And I don't know if I could tell you exactly why that's comforting. It's this like World War II story about the 101st Airborne. And honestly, so many of the episodes are pretty disruptive. And yet there's something in it to me that is stabilizing. There's this virtue that is there, this courage that is there, maybe even this resilience. One of my favorite parts in it is probably the worst part of the whole thing. And it's when they go in and defend this town in France called Bastogne. And if you've seen the series, they go into this crossroad town and are immediately surrounded by this force. And in this place, it's freezing cold. It's the middle of winter and they're not prepared. They don't have jackets. They don't have socks for their feet. And they're also very low on ammo. And they go in and they hold this spot under like attack after attack and barrage after barrage. And finally, in the end, Patton breaks through. The Battle of the Bulge occurs and they're saved. Patton comes in and liberates the town of Bastogne. But what I love about it is when they go through and they interview these soldiers, they're like, we didn't need to get rescued. Right? This is their response. Like, oh, are you so relieved? Patton came through and they're like, no, we were fine. Right? The quote from Ambrose, he says, as the story of the Battle of the Bulge is told today, it's one of George Patton and his Third Army coming to the rescue of the encircled 101st. Like the cavalry come to save the settlers in their wagon circle, no member of the 101st has ever agreed that the division needed to be rescued. And when you watch, I mean, those episodes, right, are like gut-wrenching. You see the suffering, you see the struggle, and not just that. There's a few characters in there that are injured, some even die. You realize in something like Band of Brothers, there's no, like what the kids would refer to as plot armor. Are you familiar with this term? Like plot armor is what protects the main character, right? If the main character in the story is going through, you're like, even if things are bad, that guy's fine because he's got plot armor, right? Not in this case. Like if somebody died it's a documentary, that person just dies. You feel the weight, you feel the suffering. And yet what you see there is this resilience, that resilience that came from training, came from this connection with each other, came from people understanding what they were there to do. And ultimately, in the end, this sort of resilience to me, I'm inspired by, like, how do you stand in that space? Paul is saying something similar. He's writing Philippians partially as a thank you letter to this church in Philippi. And Paul is in this place of such tragedy. He's a prisoner in chains. Not just that, but chained 24 hours a day to a centurion next to him. And he's not being fed 3 meals a day. He's sitting in this place of dependency where if people do not contribute to him, then he has nothing to eat. And so here is Paul in this really precarious position. And not only that, but he's this super driven guy. He's like the best missionary that they've got, the best evangelist. And he's sidelined over here in prison. And as this gift comes in, Paul goes, oh, I'm rejoicing. But make no mistake, like, I wasn't in need. I didn't need to be rescued. And what Paul is clarifying there is very important for us to understand his message. That it's so easy for us to see our sense of contentment and well-being derived from our circumstance. But Paul's saying, no, I was fine. Even there, I didn't need to be rescued. I rejoiced, but I rejoiced in the opportunity for you guys to have a sense of purpose and calling, generosity. You guys are understanding where true joy is. And as he sees that occur, Paul is like, my heart is filled with joy. Not because I've been rescued, but because you're starting to live into this calling, living into our purpose, living into the thing that ultimately roots us in happiness. Resilience. Resilience is an interesting thing, and we're seeing in Philippians how important that is to Paul. In fact, if there's like one admonition behind all of this, as Paul is saying, I long for you to stand firm. I long for you to endure. I long for you to press in. This is his whole thrust. How do we get this sort of strength that allows us to remain fast in the midst of circumstances that appear overwhelming? I wrote this just as like kind of a little differentiation here, that resilience is this. Resilience is about how we respond to difficulty, our capacity to absorb hardship, adapt, and move forward. This is what you see in this 101st, that they're there in the midst of what we would assume are unbearable circumstance, and their response is, we're fine. Resilience. And as Paul receives this gift, he's demonstrating to them what this resilience looks like. That we can, in the midst of everything going wrong, respond with contentment. And Paul's afraid that they're going to understand that his contentment, his rejoicing, is in the provision. And so he wants to indicate, this isn't Paul like in an unfeeling way going, no thanks, or I didn't really need that. He's like, no, I'm grateful, but I don't want you to mistake the fact that that joy is somehow in being rescued. I think partly he's going, don't see yourselves as the rescuer. That as you send this gift of generosity to me in this point of need, you are actually getting to practice the joy and contentment that comes from being right where we are supposed to be. That all meaning and depth and happiness is found in this generosity. That it's not in the receiving that joy comes. It's in the giving. Paul is trying to dispel this idea, and he's doing this all the way through Philippians, that somehow joy is derived in the right context. That it's having our needs met. That it's achieving this sense of satisfaction of all the things that we desire and our pleasures. Having this sense of control over our circumstance. Having provision not just for today or tomorrow, but indefinitely, more than enough. This is where contentment comes from. Paul's saying this is false, but it has to be unlearned. Something in us has known this sort of from the very moment that we're born, that we have needs. And when we need something, the best thing to do is cry. We cry out when we're hungry. We cry out when we're tired. We cry out when we need to be changed. And as we get older, we just get a little bit more sophisticated in how we make our needs known, don't we? Or in how we try to control our environment. that this way of sort of desperately trying to control this, we in our maturity hide a lot of that emotion, when in fact the truth is we experience those emotions as intense as we ever did. Have you ever thought that when you see a little kid tantruming and you think, no, I get that, right? Inside, that kid is falling apart, right? And we're like, compose yourself, which is what we've learned to do. But we know deep down, gosh, I just felt like that this morning, where I'm like, why, right? We feel this intensity of emotion. And then we have a whole strategy of how we cope with it. How do we meet this deep well of need within us? The answer is contentment. So we pile in everything thinking that we could somehow reach this point of satisfaction. When we do, it has this tendency to go just a little beyond our reach. Have you seen that Charlie Chaplin skit where he's, you know, comedically, he's dropped his hat and he's going to pick it up, but every time he does, his foot kicks it just a little bit further, right? So he keeps reaching as the hat goes scooting forward. And I think Paul's going, that's what this whole system is like. The more you strive after that attainment, the more that thing ends up just a little further away. How much money do we need to be satisfied? How many accolades do we need? What sort of position do we need to attain to? What level of control is going to give us satisfaction? And Paul says, it never works that way. We never grasp that thing. What did Rockefeller say when he was asked, how much more do you need? And he said, just a little bit more. I think they say comparatively Rockefeller had like $200 billion worth of, right? What do you need to be happy? Just a little bit more. Contentment. Contentment is this elusive thing. I put here, contentment is about our state of being, an inner settledness that doesn't depend on external circumstances. This is Paul's point. That contentment isn't derived from some sense of your circumstances being under control. It isn't derived from some line that we cross or some level that we reach or some attainment. It's found in this sort of internal sense of peace. Or maybe better, this shalom. This was the term that the Hebrew people would have used at that time to talk about peace, but they mean something robust by it. Shalom isn't like the absence of conflict. That would be part of it, I guess, maybe. But really, it's this wholeness, this completeness, this integrity, that things are set right. And it's not just internally within ourselves, but it's externally within our world, within our relationships, within our connections. And as Paul is going to point out, ultimately in our relationship with God. I wrote this, shalom is the state of comprehensive wholeness, harmony, and flourishing in which relationships with God, self, others, and creation are rightly ordered, justice is upheld, needs are met, and life abounds. It's both a present gift of God's kingdom and the ultimate vision towards which creation is moving. Shalom is this already, not yet. It's this experiencing of heaven here on earth. It's this realization that God's justice, though ultimately won't be satisfied until some moment beyond this life, can come in and permeate within our own hearts, within our own worlds, and extend outward from us. This is the kingdom of God. And Paul is saying that kingdom we can have now, and in that kingdom, we can have this deep sense of shalom. A shalom that poverty can't touch, nor riches. A shalom that is resilient and grounded. This is how we stand firm. And when Paul speaks to this, he would certainly speak in light of kind of the current wisdom of the day. And Paul isn't discarding this, but I think instead building upon it. Paul grew up in this little town of Tarsus, and there in Tarsus was kind of the culmination for him of Orthodox Judaism, which is how he was raised, and Greek philosophy, which had retreated from Rome to Tarsus and was kind of this center of Stoicism, and then in his own family, this Judaism. And Paul had these two concepts very intertwined. And Stoicism talks about the depth of this virtue being in a sort of detachment from these needs. It too would have said, we cannot attain these things. And so what we do instead is separate ourselves from that pursuit, from that chasing after. Seneca, a Roman philosopher at that time, right about the time that Philippians was written, wrote this. He said, the wealthy man is content with his present lot, no matter what it is, and is reconciled to his circumstances. There's a ton of wisdom in that, right? Not chasing. As Paul says, that chase is rubbish. Seneca would have agreed. But what he is teaching here is a sort of detach your heart from those things. Now, that detachment, I think there's a lot of beautiful virtue in that. But this is different than what Paul is talking about. Paul isn't talking about a sort of detachment from desire. In fact, look at how he's been setting this whole thing up. He says, rejoice. I'm rejoicing in my circumstance. I'm rejoicing in where I am. And that rejoicing is like filled with joy. This isn't this sort of dispassionate response, right? That Paul is sitting there in this prison and he's like, oh, so good. You're like, how do you do that? Are you in denial of this? Like, what's going on here? Well, Paul's saying this joy is transcendent. It's a reality that we can experience this kingdom regardless of where we are. Instead of distancing himself from his passions and emotions, he's saying these things have to ultimately reach their proper end. And for Paul, as he sees this church in Philippi responding with sacrificial generosity, he's like, this is awesome. You guys are doing so good. It's like, I have all of this joy, but not because like I'm relieved that my needs are met, but because I see you guys living into this kingdom. When we understand who God is, we respond generously. We respond sacrificially. We understand that contentment, true satisfaction is found in living this way, generously. I've been reading through this new book by Arthur Brooks that called The Happiness Files. It's this collection of essays. But Arthur Brooks, he's a professor at Harvard, but he teaches happiness, which is kind of interesting. And in all of that, he's talking about what are these ways that bring the human spirit to life. But one of the essays that he writes in there is he goes, it's generous giving. And even more so, it's generous giving in secret. He says, as hard as giving is at times, the fact that it raises our well-being is hardly a new finding. Voluntary giving is one of the fastest, most reliable ways to improve your mood. Making it part of your lifestyle can have long-term effects on your life satisfaction. What makes us happy? He's going, here's one, generous giving. And interestingly enough, there's a sort of circularity to it where he's going, people that are happy tend to give. But giving can be a way of jump-starting a sense of deep contentment. In fact, you can study it neurologically, and like it lights the brain up when we give generously. And I don't think this is some random aspect of evolution. I think this is design. It's how we're meant to live. When we talk about shalom, we're talking about living out how we were meant to live. And one of the indicators here in that design is that we are meant to live generously, giving to others, sacrificing for the sake of others. Paul, as he sees them, he's like, I'm so stoked. Why? Because they're his crown. He's talked about that already at the start of chapter 1. He's like, you guys, that church, you are my beloved church there in Philippi. I love you guys. He says, you're my crown. Like ultimately in the end, when Paul's life has been lived, what will he present as the testimony for his life well lived? This church growing in their understanding of God and his kingdom and intimacy and contentment and all of these things. So as Paul sees them flourishing, he's like, oh, this is good for my soul. This takes us beyond human wisdom. It takes us in a way beyond virtue into this way of understanding what the Greeks would call telos, our end, our purpose, our very design. And Paul is going to say he's learned this, and this is very important, that this is not natural to us. We learn this step by step through life, and we learn this through experience. Life teaches us this thing. And as we do, as we navigate through these realities, we start to learn to make better and better choices as we go. In Proverbs 30, there's this great prayer by this guy, Augur, who we think may be Solomon writing, you know, like under a different name. But whoever this was, he says this prayer. He says, God, give me two things. Make me honest. But the second thing is, he says, give me neither poverty or wealth. In these verses, he says, give me neither poverty nor wealth. Feed me with the food I need. Otherwise, I might have too much and deny you, saying, who is the Lord? Or I might have nothing and steal, profaning the name of God. Augur understands something here that Paul's going to build upon and take further. Augur understands that, like, true contentment is found in a sort of balance between these points. He's saying, God, if you give me too little, I know what it's going to do. I'm going to become a victim and I'm going to go steal something, and I don't want to do that. So, God, don't give me too little. But also, wisely, don't give me too much. Why? Because I know where that leads. When my life is comfortable, when I have every pleasure, when I have all these things met, what do? I start to feel entitled. I start to take credit for those things. I feel like I've earned this, or I deserve this, or it's mine. And Augur wisely sees the danger there. This is going to disconnect me from this place of dependence on God. And that is going to lead to disillusionment. It's going to lead to ultimately what Ecclesiastes refers to as vanity. That when we get everything that we think we want, it doesn't satisfy it. It leads to disillusionment. We end up numb and unable to experience the joy and the rejoicing. Augur saying, keep me in that right place. But Paul is saying, it actually isn't about being in that just daily bread. That maturity, the secret, is that if we really understand the source of this, you can be in either and be just fine. Instead of being in poverty and stealing, or instead of being in prosperity and ignoring or forgetting God, you are actually able in either of those places to stay in this place of deep connection, intimacy, and abiding with God. That's the goal. That is the secret. That's the life hack. And Paul tells us it had to be learned. He says, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstance I find myself. I know how to make do with little, and I know how to make do with a lot. In any and all circumstances, I've learned the secret of being content, whether well-fed or hungry, whether in abundance or in need. I'm able to do all things through him who strengthens me. How did Paul learn this? Well, he understands something that is a good reminder for all of us, that we are all in God's school of love, that life is a lab, and that we're being shown something, we're being taught something as we go, that when we experience the difficulties of life, we learn. When we experience the prosperities of life, there too, we learn. That it's not just in difficulties and then God meets those needs and everything fine. No, in fact, in all of life, we're learning how to practice contentment and dependence and reliance upon God. Sometimes the best lessons for us are those times of desolation. And Paul had plenty. 2 Corinthians 4:8 and 9, he says, we're afflicted in every way but not crushed, perplexed but not in despair, persecuted but not abandoned, struck down but not destroyed. This is a realization for Paul. I wonder if in some of these moments he thought, that's it, we're destroyed. That's where I tend to go. When I imagine kind of worst possible scenarios, I have this way of thinking, oh, if that happens, I'm dead. Which is a little over-dramatized, which just probably says something about me. It's my way of romanticizing my pain or something like that. But I've literally thought this at times of my life, that like, if this happens, that'll be it. That's what's going to break me. I had a moment in my life where I feel like everything I was trying to avoid just happened. It all unfolded, like boom, boom, boom. And then when the end result came, it was worse than I thought I was going to be. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. This is where Jeff's going to snap. And I sat there in this, I mean, my first thought was like, am I dreaming? I'm like, I'm not dreaming. This is really happening. And then I thought, oh, this is where I die. And then I thought, I think I'm okay. And this thing in that situation to go like, oh, wow, right? I had this built up one way. And you realize that most of the time when we're doing that, we're looking at our hand. These are the cards that I have to play. And I'm like, I'm out. I fold, right? Except God is there. He's like, I still have a few more cards, Jeff, relax, right? And that card that he plays, this is called grace. That there's this sufficiency of what God can still do when I'm out of options. Paul's saying to understand that when you're in that place, learn from that. That God is enough, that God can do this. I was talking to Kurt about this in between services, and this idea that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were these three guys that in the Old Testament were going to get thrown in this furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar was like, bow to me, and they're like, we won't. And he's like, do you really think your God's going to save you? And their response is like, well, we don't know if he will, but we know he can, and that's enough. Right? That there's this sense of like, however he responds, I know what he's capable of doing, and I trust him. How do you learn that? You learn it by life, by experience, by standing in those places. Most of us are trying to avoid that thing, which is why we probably lift this verse out of context and like sew it on pillows and write it on t-shirts. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And what we mean is, through Christ, you'll win the Super Bowl. I always thought it was interesting when it was Packers versus the Seahawks, and both quarterbacks, who that's who God blesses, by the way, both were Christians. And I was like, oh, what's God going to do? I was like, I guess we're going to find out who's the better Christian. Right? I can do all things through Christ, which means I can attain any victory if I just have faith. Right? Wrong. Paul's saying, win or lose, I'm content. However this goes, I'm good. If there's blessing, great. If there's not, what does he say? Like, in life, yes. In death, yes. That Christ is the answer. Death, in fact, is gain. That he lives in this place of such resilience and contentment, such peace in these situations, that he's like, the outcome doesn't matter. I mean, it's okay to care about the Super Bowl. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that ultimately in the end, it's not this formula of control. It's not this religious way of kind of controlling God's hand. It is this detachment, but with this sense of deep assurance that God is here, God is at work. Paul is the proof of this reality. They're in this place of having everything stripped from him. He's just living into still his calling. He's going, this is still plan A. So what he's doing, he's preaching the gospel to the guy he's chained next to and praying for the churches in Philippi and hoping to be set free, but really living his life through their prospering and their success. There's a story that I love that if you've done premarital counseling with me, I always tell this story, and it's my second war reference today. So sorry for that. It's a little bit of a violent morning, I guess. But there's for this book called Through the Gates of Fire that's written about these Spartan soldiers. 300 of them went up against Persia, and this sort of incredible historical story of resilience. And in this book, Pressfield goes through going, what is it that makes them so strong? And one of the things he latches onto is the fact that in battle, if they dropped their shield, they were stripped of their citizenship. It was the one taboo. The one thing they could not do was drop their shield. They could lose any other part. Drop your helmet, doesn't matter. Because to drop your helmet just exposed you. But this defense was built around this point, that their shield was not for them. It's how they protected the person next to them. And so that person's safety, that person's strength was your shield. If you dropped it, their life was forfeit. And that sense of ownership over each other created this resilience and this strength. That sense of sacrifice. You could see why this might apply to marriage. You go like, my shield is for you. But as the church of Philippi is going, like, we are here to provide for Paul. And Paul's going, my satisfaction and contentment is in you flourishing. It's in this sense of the other. This is where I draw deep meaning. Paul's going, what that brings is a deep sense of peace, a deep sense of purpose, in fact, a deep sense of joy. This is what I'm here to do. And as we practice that sort of self-sacrificial living, it puts us in this place of dependence. And some of that is a beautiful sort of dependence on others. But ultimately, in the end, that's not what Paul's saying. He's not saying you can do all things through the strength of the church. He's saying you can do all things because God is your shield. God sees you. God knows you. God promises to protect. That's your resilience. I love, you know, in the 23rd Psalm is this promise that we are not alone, no matter where we are. In one translation of it, it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I have all that I need. That verse has become like a mantra for me. I'm constantly worried about managing what I have. Do I have the resources? Do I have enough? And that promise, the Lord is your shepherd, you have everything you need. He's allowed, Liz. Leo can do whatever he wants to do. Sweet new baby. The Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. He lets me rest in green meadows. He leads me beside peaceful streams. He renews my strength. He guides me along right paths, bringing honor to his name. That's like as far as I want to go. Ah, green pastures. Quiet rivers. But no, even when I walk through the darkest valley, I'll not be afraid, for you are close beside me. Your rod and your staff protect and comfort me. You prepare a feast for me in the presence of my enemies. You honor me by anointing my head with oil. My cup overflows with blessings. Surely your goodness and unfailing love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will live in the house of the Lord forever. In pastures, in rivers, yes, but also in darkest valleys or in the presence of enemies. When I'm presented with these moments of weakness, I find myself going, I have everything I need. You are with me. This is part of the exercise. This is part of how we learn, right? Paul is not saying, like, I got this a long time ago. He's like, I've learned this. And in fact, he's even said, I'm learning this. That we live this out in life. We experience it. And when we see God in those places of brokenness, we experience his grace, his sufficiency, and that we have enough. Sometimes just enough, but enough. And I'm freed from all that need to try to control and possess and accumulate and all of those things. I can just let it go and just enjoy, to notice the beauty in those settings, to pay attention to the fact that he's near. So often in my worry, I lose sight. I get so obsessed and so focused on this small thing in front of me that I lose sight that God is with me. So Paul's saying, like, let go of those fears, understand that God is close by, and notice, pay attention to those things. How do we do this? Well, he says, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there's any moral excellence, if there's anything praiseworthy, dwell on these things. Do what you've learned and received and heard from me and seen in me, and the God of peace will be with you. In order to understand this, we have to pay attention. And we have to notice. But this permission to focus our attention on what is good, to notice those things of beauty and depth and character. He's going like, think about those things. Dwell in those places. Have your eyes attuned to beauty. You think about this, and I know I like constantly harp on social media, but you're going, so often what we're like, oh, that's a funny little cat video with a cucumber, or whatever that is, right? These things that amuse or distract, or things that we worry about, things that create in us fear, all of these different things that we try to manage in our lives through distraction. Paul's saying, don't focus on what is good. Another little Arthur Brooks tidbit, he said, if you interview the happiest people, what you find is they all do this one thing. They all read. And he's like, not just like, I need the answer to this test question. They read because they're like, I want to know more. I want to understand more. In some ways, this is what Paul is saying, is he's like, you need to like look and pursue, lean into, understand the depth. Long to understand, what does it mean to be content? He's like, you are being shown. Notice it. What do we do with the fear? What do we do with the worry? He's going to say, don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank Him for all He has done. Then you will experience God's peace, which exceeds anything we can understand. His peace will guard your hearts and your minds as you live in Christ Jesus. That peace becomes our shield. We turn to God in prayer. We reflect on the things that are beautiful, and we respond with a deep sense of gratefulness. This can take work. I heard someone say recently that he was an orphan and grew up as an orphan, and noticed that this kind of striking reality that in an orphanage at night it's quiet. He said, the children there have learned that there's no reason to cry, that hope is not coming. And I think for some of us, we bear these wounds and we've learned how to care for them by detaching ourselves from those desires. Protecting ourselves, guarding our hearts from where we've been hurt or let down or disappointed. In some ways, what we're having to do is step out in vulnerability and learn how to hope again. This becomes a part of our learning, to lean into the vulnerability of that space. Brené Brown talks about joy as being very, very vulnerable. She writes, in our research, we found that everyone who shows a deep capacity for joy had one thing in common. They practiced gratitude. In the midst of joy, there's often a quiver, a shudder of vulnerability. Rather than using that as a warning sign to practice imagining the worst case scenario, which I'm guilty of, the people who lean into joy use the quiver as a reminder to practice gratitude. I've started doing this just as a regular practice. Each morning when I sit down to journal, I just write down three things that I'm grateful for. And I try to write something down that I haven't written yet. To notice, to pay attention. It's a simple little exercise. It may even sound a little bit cheesy, but oftentimes I realize, oh, I am grateful, but I didn't notice. And so I don't even experience the gratitude until I pause and go, oh, I'm actually very thankful for that. Sometimes the thing I'm grateful for is the thing that I'm wrestling with or struggling or worried about. And then I go, oh, wow, but I'm grateful to have this opportunity. I'm grateful to have a God who is leading me further, who wants to show me more, who is wanting me to know that He's with me when it's hard. When I write those things down, I want to notice those little things that are otherwise so easily taken for granted. Little moments like walking down to the beach with my kids and just being like, I'm so grateful to jump into the ocean and it's 70 degrees. And these little beautiful, tiny things along the way that end up becoming very nourishing moments. Ways that God says, I'm here, Jeff. Don't get lost in the worry. These things allow me to lay down in green pastures, but they also allow me to walk through those dark valleys. This might be a good exercise to practice gratitude with intentionality, to discipline yourself, to not worry, but instead to focus on what is lovely. Paul's going to tell us, give thanks in all things. Stop worrying and respond prayerfully. He reminds us to stop chasing after the approval of others. It will never satisfy us. There is literally never enough approval out there to bring contentment. That way is broken and cannot be fixed or restored. That it's not about finding those things externally, but ultimately about finding those things in God. And this to me is the key in all of this, is that he goes, this is not about resigning myself to my present circumstances. This is about me realizing that true contentment lies in this sense of like the eyes of my Father looking at me with pleasure. This is the ultimate place. This is where we can literally do all things, is when we stand before God and understand that his affirmation, that belovedness is already ours. That his word over us is, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Paul isn't just sitting back in prison complacently. He's striving into this. He's pressing into this. This is the one thing he's clutching to, and it's to God. He's going, that is who we seek to please with all our heart, not to earn his love, but because he's already loved us. Lewis says this in The Weight of Glory. He says, talking about this moment where in a moment of like success, he realizes for himself that like what happens, either he's so afraid of failure or when he does succeed, he knows he will take credit for it. And he goes, but I thought I could detect a moment, a very, very short moment before this happened, during which the satisfaction of having pleased those whom I rightly loved and rightly feared was pure. And that is enough to raise our thoughts to what may happen when the redeemed soul, beyond all hope and nearly beyond belief, learns at last that she's pleased him with whom she was created to please. There will be no room for vanity then. She will be free from the miserable illusion that it is her doing. With no taint of what we should now call self-approval, she will most innocently rejoice in the thing that God has made her to be. Ultimately, in the end, Paul's going, that's contentment. To stand there in that place of freedom. He says, when we've emptied these things, when we've gone the way of the cross, what we find on the other side is glory. But not a glory that we possess for ourselves, not a self-sufficiency of contentment, but a glory that is completely surrendered, a heart that knows that they belong, and can then, from that place of this well of grace, give generously to others. We're going to have one more song in which to respond. But before we do, in our like final invitation, I want to give you some journaling prompts for the week, if that's all right. And if you don't have a journal, there's one free in the back you can grab. But the first is to practice gratitude. You can maybe take on this little practice that I've started doing if you'd like, naming three things daily that you're grateful for. Number two, to practice like a joy discipline, to dwell. Where do you dwell? To dwell on what is lovely and noble and praiseworthy. To catch yourself when you fall into that place of distraction or when you go spiraling off into the news or whatever that thing is. Not to bury your head in the sand, but to instead make sure that our focus is on the things that ultimately in the end matter most. Lovely, noble, praiseworthy. When we find ourselves wavering, to practice this resilience, Christ is strengthening you to be content, regardless of where you find yourself, whether today you find yourself in plenty or in want. I can do all things through Christ, and identify lastly in his delight. When you feel that quiver inside, to turn towards God and to hear him say, "You're my beloved child, in you I'm well pleased."